The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to Inside the Game, my friends. I'm Pat Williams, your host. We gather like this every weekend right here on AM 660, The Answer in Orlando. And we get to talk sports with a wide range of interesting people. We get on the air because of Jeff Sennis. He does our engineering. And Andrew Hurd Liska produces the show. My guest in the first segment, Joe Bonomo, he is a teacher in the Department of English at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois. The book is called No Place I Would Rather Be, Roger Angel and a Life in Baseball Writing. Hi, Joe. How are you?
Hi, Pat. I'm doing great. Thanks.
Oh, where did your interest? Well, first of all, who was Roger Angel? Tell us about him, please.
Well, Roger Angel, I think, quite simply, is the greatest living American baseball writer. He was born in 1920. And had a career as a fiction writer, short story writer, published a book in 1960, but was a longtime avid fan of baseball. And in the mid-50s, he joined the New Yorker magazine as a fiction editor. And a few years later, his then-editor, William Shawn, asked him, who was hopeful for more sports writing in the New Yorker. They'd covered boxing and football and tennis and other things. But he always encouraged his writers to explore what they loved and what they were curious about and what interested them. And he asked Roger Angel if he might consider writing about baseball. This was in 1962. Roger Angel was already 42 years old. And he went down to spring training that year, the year the New York Mets had their first season. And he wrote a little report from spring training, and he's been writing about baseball ever since.
Is he still living at 98, or has he passed?
He is indeed still living.
Wow.
Yeah, and in fact, healthy, very sharp-minded as well in our many conversations. Yeah, he's doing very well.
What prompted you to do this book?
Well, as with a lot of my books, I tend to write from the from the fan's perspective. And when I was in high school, I noticed a book on my dad's bookshelf, Late Innings, Roger Angel's baseball book that was published in 1982. And I took it off the shelf, and I started reading it, and I fell in love almost immediately with Angel's writing, the breadth of it, and the smart, and the intelligence, and the beautiful way he sort of brings his fiction writer's eye to writing, to describing an at-bat, and a team, and a season, et cetera. And I started reading all of Angel that I could after that, looking forward to his three reports or three essays he would write each year, one in spring training, and then a mid-season kind of check-in, and then his great postseason recap, usually in October or November. And I loved them all along and when I was reading them all the years. And it struck me a few years back that it would be a really interesting book to try and to chart his career, because we're really not going to see the likes of him again, I think. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book.
Was he a critic of baseball or a fan?
Always a fan, and also always a critic. Smartly, I think. In fact, what I found most interesting, among the things I found really interesting in researching and writing the book, was to discover, in fact, how much disillusionment Roger felt about the game over the course of the many decades he's been writing. TV, for example, he was born in 20, remember, so he became a fan of baseball in his teens, as we all do, and that was the 1930s, so this is well before TV broadcasting, and he followed all the games on the radio. So he, when TV began to sort of exert its influence, starting in the 50s, but really cresting in the 60s and the 70s, he was very cold about it at first. He was dubious about television coverage, and that never quite went away, even though he's a fan of much of what TV can do now. But that's just one example. League expansion was also something he found problematic in the 60s and into the 70s. The sort of monolithic AstroTurf dome stadiums was another thing that bothered him. the early over, what he saw as the over reliance on statistics was something else that he was a little bit dubious about. So yeah, he's been a lifelong fan, but also a skeptic. He's a native skeptic. It's to his temperament, I think, and so he's always been careful to regard baseball objectively and critically as well as with a fan's eye.
Joe, I'm doing a little math here. He could very well have seen Babe Ruth play and Lou Gehrig and Jimmy Fox and Rogers Hornsby and, all the immortals of the game. Do you think that happened?
Oh, it most certainly happened. Yeah, I mean, when I say that we're never going to see the likes of him, no one has a through line in baseball like Roger Angel. It's really, really astonishing, startling, to use one of Roger's favorite words. He saw Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig hit back-to-back home runs in Yankee Stadium.
Mm.
And he also blogged the 2018 postseason. He saw Joe DiMaggio play, and he's seen Barry Bonds play. He watched Mel Ott in the outfield as a young man, and then he watched Daniel Murphy hit home runs in the playoffs. Murphy, who was born 40 years after Mel Ott retired. So that gives you an indication just how amazingly wide his experience is in the game.
How did he get to? How has he gotten to live to 98? Any secrets?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't asked him. Good genes, good luck. I assume good health. I know he enjoys a nightly scotch, a nightly Dewars. I don't know if that's still part of his routine, but maybe that has something to do with it.
And they didn't even have kale around when he was growing up.
No, they didn't.
So. It's an amazing story. Is he still writing well? Does he still follow things? Is he?
He is. It slowed down considerably. He started blogging at thenewyorker.com in 2008, cheerfully, I might add. His last print-only postseason recap appeared 10 years ago, following the Yankees' defeat of the Phillies in the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, he's sort of blogged serially about the season, a few times during the summer, and until the last World Series, he was blogging routinely during the series, every day, often or every other day. That slowed down a bit last season, but as far as I know, he's still writing, still has ideas, and still has things to say.
We're talking with Joe Bonomo in DeKalb, Illinois, a big fan of the great baseball writer Roger Angel. The book is called No Place I Would Rather Be. What has Roger done with writing books?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Books by Roger Angel. What's the story there?
Well, it's interesting because until he wrote a book called A Pitcher's Story, which is a full-length book about David Cone, the great pitcher, that appeared in 2001 or 2002, he had never written a book, as he says, with a from beginning, middle to end. All of his books are collections of his New Yorker essays, and so it's especially interesting to read, starting with this first book, Summer Game, which was published in 1972, I believe. It's interesting to read each of his books, which were during the course of his career published every 5 or 10 years or so, to get a glimpse into each of the eras in the seasons that he wrote. So you can see his writing in the 60s when he started writing into the 70s, and then his writing of the 70s into the 80s. And each of his books reflects not only Angel's longstanding love and interest in the game, but also the way the game itself has changed, both on the field and off the field. So his books, for the most part, are collections of his writing, and they hold together remarkably well.
Tell me more about the David Cone book.
It's an interesting story. He admired Cone when he first played with the Royals and especially with the Mets. And pitchers in particular have always fascinated Angel. One of his most famous pieces is called Distance, the Profile of Bob Gibson, which is often anthologized for their sort of lonely task there on the mound and the singularly difficult job of pitching to these elite sluggers. So he's always been interested in pitching. In fact, he pitched for a while when he was a kid until he got to high school, and later on when he realized the limitations of his own athletic skills and gifts. But he was especially admired Cone. And Cone approached Angel, actually, with the idea of writing a book. And at first, Angel balked, saying, you know, I don't write books. I gather my essays in the collections. But Cohen finally talked him into it, as well as his publisher.
Mm.
And what's interesting about the book is that it changed course very dramatically during the writing of it, because Cohen became injured and lost a lot of his elite skill. And the book that Angel ended up writing was a book less about an elite pitcher at the top of his game than an elite pitcher who has suffered an alarming setback and had to figure out and learn how to pitch again and also suffer surgeries and these sorts of things. So it's a really interesting book because it changed course. And Angel then also had to reconceive what his idea or conception of the book would be. And it ended up being a very interesting book about an elite player who recognizes his own limitations and his own sort of the limits of his physical prowess. It's a fascinating book.
Kind of interesting, Joe. You mentioned Roger Angel's great interest in pitchers. Tyler Kepner of the New York Times, the new book is out.
Oh, yes.
This week, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. And it's his study of pitchers and their best pitch. So Roger Angel is not alone with the fascination about pitchers.
Oh, no. And in fact, Kepner's book sounds fascinating. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, you know, I just got it last night. I just got it yesterday. And it looks, it's called K, you know.
Yeah.
A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. Endorsed by Joe Buck, Bob Costas, Jane Levy, Oral Hershiser, Tim McGraw, and George Will.
Wow, well, there you go.
So that's impressive.
Indeed.
So what do you teach in the Department of English? What's a classroom of yours like, Joe?
I teach primarily creative writing, especially or particularly creative nonfiction. So I teach essay writing and memoir writing and autobiographical writing, and I also teach literature classes of memoir and autobiography.
So what are you seeing with young people today? Do they write well?
They do. The knock against so many of the so-called millennials, and of course I've been teaching for a long time, so I've seen a lot of so-called generations of kids. When they apply themselves, especially when they are interested to know more about what they think they know about something, whether it's their own life or their adolescence, their childhood, their family, or something outside of themselves, when they follow their curiosity, when they follow their bliss into wanting to learn more about something, the essays they write can be wonderful, can be remarkable. And they're all great readers, too. I've been very lucky with my students here at NIU.
Our guest is Joe Bonomo. More with Joe right after these messages on Inside the Game with Pat Williams. It's AM 660, The Answer in Orlando. Joe Bonomo is in DeKalb, Illinois. He's authored the book No Place I Would Rather Be. It's about the great baseball writer Roger Angel. In your book, Joe, you do a chapter called You Want to Laugh? You Want More? You Want It to Be Over? What's going on in that chapter? What are you writing about?
I'm writing about the I've divided the book into sections, and that's the last section of the book where I focus on Roger's great writing in October in the baseball playoffs, the championship games and the World Series. And that's a quote from Roger directly where he's describing the intense pleasure mania that a fan feels when a game, an October game especially, is tightening up and is getting very tense, and the tension is becoming almost impossible. It's difficult, especially if your teams are involved, but it's also deeply pleasurable. So I write about a few of the World Series games in particular that really galvanized Roger, both as a fan and as a writer, and it's some of his best writing, I think.
Joe Torre has said, "The game of baseball best represents our country's soul." What do you think that means, Joe?
Well, I think that Joe Torre is responding to what I think is the greatness of Roger Angel is writing about baseball, in that he's not simply Angel, that is, he's not simply writing about baseball, but he's also writing about something larger. And I think what I've discovered in writing this book, and one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, frankly, was to discover what are the common threads that I can pull among all of Angel's writing, from his earliest baseball writing in the 1950s when he was writing a couple pieces for Holiday Magazine, where he was an editor, through to his early baseball pieces at the New Yorker and into the present. And I think that Torrey really nails it there, that, yes, it's a game. It's men playing inside of a diamond and on green grass. But there are so many things about baseball that we can apply to what it means to live daily lives as human beings outside of the game. There's so much loss, in fact, much more loss in baseball than there is winning and victory. Any baseball player, any fan knows that. There's so much bad luck involved, as well as good luck. Randomness, another word that you really can't control. And the famous adage that a baseball player who hits 300 over his career is a player who we can agree on had a sterling career, but that means, famously, that he failed 7 times out of 10 at the plate. That is, failed to get a hit 7 times out of 10. Not that he didn't have productive at-bats, but in the old-school way of thinking, he failed to get a hit 7 out of 10 times at bat, which means he failed 7 out of 10 times. That sounds a lot like life to me, doesn't it? Fail 7 times out of every 10 times that we succeed. So I think there is a lot in baseball that reflects the human condition.
Joe, when Tom Verducci says Roger Angel is an American treasure, what do you think that means?
I think part of what Torrey means, too, that Angel has showed us in his baseball writing that what appears to be a trifling sport, a trifling game played among adults, is in fact a kind of barometer on which we can enjoy and share our pleasures of the game, but also reflect on some of what it means to be alive. I think to be a human being. But I also think, and perhaps more to the point, Verducci is talking about Angel's writing there. He is an absolute American treasure as a writer. He brings to bear on the writing of a baseball game a fiction writer's ear for dialogue and a fiction writer's eye for significant details and for scene setting. And nobody writes about an at-bat. Nobody describes an at-bat as well as Roger Angel. And when you read all of his books together, or even just one of his books, you get such a remarkable feel for the breadth of, say, a decade's worth of baseball and the pleasures and the joys, but also the agonies and the heartbreaks that the game gives. And no one has written about it quite as memorably and as thoughtfully and as artfully as Angel, in my way of thinking. And I know that Verducci shares my feelings about Angel. So that's what makes Angel a real American treasure among writers.
Joe Bonomo is our guest. The book, No Place I Would Rather Be, University of Nebraska Press put it out, Roger Angel and a Life in Baseball Writing. Joe, if we could sit down with Roger Angel now and ask him to share with us his biggest concerns about baseball, the future of baseball, what do you think he would tell us?
I think he would probably be concerned about the ever-escalating cost of the game, the ever-escalating salaries. Not that the players don't deserve them, that is, the deserving ones, because Angel was very, very much on the side, and Phil is on the side of the players and the players' union in the many skirmishes between the many labor skirmishes that have besmirched the game for all these years. So he believes that the players deserve what they can get paid. But he's also aware of the astronomical costs of the game in terms of ticket prices and concessions and parking. And I know that he's also somewhat concerned, I mean, depending on what day you talk to him, very concerned about the way that baseball is viewed now among the common fan. In particular, you go to the park and there are so many distractions. There's so much spectacle of the ballpark now that it almost appears that teams and venues are trying to distract a fan from the game, what with the concessions and all of the all of the attractions on the concourses, et cetera, the food and the drinking and the private booths, the sky boxes, the giant screens, et cetera, which is something he's been aware of course, since the 1960s, but has never lost, I think, his concern that that is a distraction from the game rather than something that benefits the game. And so I think those kinds of contemporary spectacle diversions, I think, is something that that concerns him.
I wonder what Roger Angel would say if we said, Roger, tell us five or six baseball personalities from all time that you'd love to sit down with and have lunch and talk to. Who do you think he'd tell us?
Well, he, in fact, has gone on record and written about some of his favorite personalities. The one who pops to mind first is Earl Weaver, the great Baltimore Orioles manager, who Roger used to love visiting after games, as he's written about before. Weaver, whether it was a win, whether the Orioles won or lost, would usually greet the visiting press corps stark naked, standing in his shower shoes, not always, of course, but often standing in his shower shoes without any other clothes, chewing on a chicken wing and swigging a beer and talking for as long as anyone would want to listen to him about what went wrong or what went right in that game. And I know that Weaver really, really tickled him in that way. He was also a fan of Bill Veeck, the late great owner of the Chicago White Sox. He loved to especially loved to visit him when he was sitting in the stands, as Beck often did, surrounded by fans, his leg up, reminding Angel, as he did every time he saw him, that baseball is a game that should be enjoyed before anything else. I think he also really admires, and in fact is friends with Joe Torre, who he really has admired for his sort of stoic calm that he brought to the game, as well as his sort of baseball life or wisdom. And I know he was also a fan of Dan Quisenberry, Tom Seaver, Carl Yastrzemski was a player who he admired tremendously, and I know would love to sit down and talk the game with.
Well, I've just made a reservation at Neary's in New York, an Irish pub there, Joe, a table for seven. We'll put Roger at the head table, and then around the table we'll have Joe Torre, Earl Weaver, Bill Veeck, Dan Quisenberry, Tom Seaver, and Carl Yastrzemski.
That's fabulous. Can I come?
Yes, if you'd pick up the bill.
I you didn't have to ask me.
You'd pick up the bill. Okay.
I got it. That would be fabulous.
Joe, well, if you go, you know, I'd like to sit in as well, but that table's getting awfully crowded.
And, the more the merrier, don't you think?
Well, that could be. That could be. Yeah. I'll allow you to sit on the edge with a tape recorder.
Oh, I'd be more than happy to.
And we'd have to probably allow, I would think about 3 hours.
Oh, at least. I think we'd only be getting started.
Yeah, we'd need 3 hours. Now, Joe Torre is still living.
Indeed.
Yaz is in good shape. Mm-hmm. Seaver's living, but not doing well.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate news we've learned recently.
Yeah, the others are not living, but that sounds spectacular.
It would be a blast, wouldn't it?
Did Joe Angel have a favorite team? Did Roger Angel have a favorite team?
He did indeed. He grew up as a New York Giants fan.
Uh-huh.
And was a regular visitor at the Polo Grounds. When they left, he was heartbroken, of course, like so many New Yorkers were. And when the Mets arrived in 62, they essentially replaced the Giants in his heart. And so he became, at that moment, a lifelong New York Mets fan. The Red Sox were his mother's favorite team, Mother Catherine's team. And so he grew up visiting her and his stepfather, E.B. White, at their cottage in Maine, surrounded by Red Sox fans and lifers. And so he also grew up as a Red Sox fan. So those are his two favorite teams, the Red Sox and the Mets. He's also admired the Yankees in kind of a neighborly way, and he's also admired and been a fan of the San Francisco Giants after they left. But it's the Mets and the Red Sox, following the New York Giants' departure from Manhattan, that are his two favorite teams.
I wonder if Roger ever hooked up with Ted Williams.
That's a good question. I can't remember now offhand if he did. I believe that he met him off the field in a completely non-baseball related way. But I can't now remember if, because he retired after Roger started, just before, I should say, Roger started that writing about baseball for the New Yorker. So I know they met at spring training over the years when Williams would arrive as sort of an ambassador for the Red Sox. So they have met on occasion, yeah, and he's written about that.
Joe Bonomo has been our guest. The book, No Place I Would Rather Be. We've got more after this on Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and this is AM 660, The Answer in Orlando. Joe Bonomo wrote the book, and that was our first guest today. No Place I Would Rather Be, a book about the great baseball writer Roger Angel, who is 98 years old and still doing well. We're going to continue talking baseball. There's a new book out, and this is the time of year, by the way, when baseball books are coming out en masse. This is a good one, Inside the Empire, The True Power Behind the New York Yankees. Bob Clappish and Paul Solotaroff did the book, and Paul is with us from New York, veteran feature writer at Rolling Stone, Men's Journal magazines. Inside the Empire. Paul, welcome. How are you?
I'm great, Pat. Thanks for having me.
So what was it like working with Bob, and how long did it take to put the book together, and how were you able to get to so many interesting people connected with the Yankees?
So I'll tell you quickly how we came to the book. Both Bob and I are old friends, dating back to a story we crossed paths on. I wrote about the two surviving sons of Mickey Mantle.
Oh, yes.
Back in, it must be 2002. I'd seen Bob around the press box before. He's sort of unmissable. Big, strong, strapping guy. Really good-looking dude. I wound up writing a story about him many years later that was notorious for many reasons, but all of them having to do with baseball on and off the field. In any event, we were sitting at lunch a couple of years ago looking at this Yankee roster after Cashman had made these big deals, trading off his best relievers for seven superb prospects, one of whom was Gleyber Torres. And what we found was that there was a super team forming on the horizon that we wanted to write about. More to the point, we wanted to write about what Brian Cashman had done, this miracle that had never been done before. And that is, he had completely transformed his legacy franchise, most famous in all of sports, from essentially the Queen Mary, you know, a stately old grand, and when he took over in 1998 as general manager, into a super yacht, into a vessel capable of going 100 knots an hour with a helipad and global positioning and contact with all its assets around the world, and had done so without ever losing or tearing down his existing team. Never been done before in all of sports. Never certainly been done in baseball, where in just this last decade, we have watched the Cubs obliterate themselves to get better. We've watched the Astros tear it down to the joists. We've watched the Indians do it. We've watched the Red Sox do it. All teams that have gone on to play for big things. And in the Red Sox case, won a bunch of titles. So Cashman did this, but he did it behind the scenes. Instead of spending all the stupid money that George ordered him to spend on somebody else's atrocious, if not atrocious, then atrocious on the field, then atrocious off the field, over-the-hill asset. And I don't have to know any of the names here. Yankee fans will know who I'm talking about in the early 2000s. What he did instead was to quietly and powerfully build the talent chain supply line in ways nobody could see. So the Yankees were dead last in quantitative analysis people when he began building out the department in 2005, 2006. 1986. It's now by far the biggest in all of baseball. He massively overhauled their international and domestic pro and scouting operations. He centralized power in New York. The Yankees were the only team in all sports with two power bases, one in New York, one in Tampa, part of George's madness. George, an extremely paranoid man, wanted to divide power, much like a certain current president, and make sure that everyone ultimately fought with one another and then had to come to him for a decision. The minute he stepped down and was replaced by his complete nuclear opposite, his son, Hal Steinbrenner, Cashman finally had a partner with whom he could undertake this huge rebuild while nobody was watching. In the book, we compare it to running a three-star restaurant and continuing to serve, Michelin-starred meals while you're gutting the kitchen and the storeroom. So he did this thing and won approval from Hal, but they needed the money to fund this massive build-out. And for that, we profile the third member of this power triumvirate, who was Randy Levine. And Levine has always been talked about in shadowy terms for 25 years. Huge power player in baseball, but nobody really knew what he did. Well, as we detail in one very explosive chapter, he not only built the Yankees a new stadium in the Bronx over George's vociferous objections. George hated the Bronx, wanted out of there in the worst way, but over tenacious resistance from the community. And not only did he get the stadium built, he kept all his promises to the community. So thanks to him, the South Bronx now has a huge number of affordable apartments, vastly improved public transportation outlets, huge improvements to the major artery that serves that part of the Bronx, the major Deegan Highway. And then he did something that no one thought he could do. He built the first big regional sports network in baseball over the cartel-like resistance of the dominant cable companies in New York at the time. And then he nearly brokered a deal that nobody thought was a good idea, but which he was essentially ordered to by George, which was the sale of the New York Yankees to the worst ownership in sports, the Dolans, who own the Knicks and Rangers and have managed or mismanaged both franchises into ignominy. And Randy told us about the deal that wasn't, which has been huge news here in New York. There is no more loathsome figure in New York politics or culture than James Dolan. Hated by everyone, and he could have owned the Knicks, the Rangers, and the New York Yankees. But thanks to his own ineptitude, he said no to an $800 million purchase price for the New York Yankees in 1998, and later turned down half ownership of their fledgling TV network, the YES Network. Well, fast forward 20 years, the Yankees are worth between $4 and $5 billion, which is roughly what their network is worth. So for $800 million, he could have had assets now worth $9 billion. Instead, he got $30 million for the Yankees to exit their TV deal with his father's cable company and start their own.
Paul,
$30 million versus $9 billion.
Paul Solotaroff is our guest. Paul, how would you describe the Brian Cashman George Steinbrenner relationship?
Well, it was difficult. Cashman despised the way George ran the team on the back pages of the New York Post, constantly critiquing his own players, constantly critiquing Joe Torre, constantly critiquing his general manager. And he also hated that George essentially gutted the talent pipeline that produced the core four, got rid of these brilliant men who drafted and developed Derek Jeter, Andy Pettit, Jorge Posada, Bernie Williams, Mariano Rivera. One of them was Brian Sabian, who went on to build a dynasty for the San Francisco Giants. And that left Cashman in the really distasteful spot of having to go out and sign people he did not want to sign. Over the hill, over-expensive free agents like Randy Johnson, Gary Sheffield, Kevin Brown, who were poison in the clubhouse. And it's no accident that after the Yankees began to spend through the nose for these guys and to trade for people like A-Rod, their dynasty ended, though they won the most games in baseball by far from the years 2001 through 2008. They never got over the hump again, in large part because of the really acrid chemistry in that clubhouse. So when George stepped down because of illness, and his progressive, publicity-averse, credit-deflecting son Hal took over, Cashman suddenly had a full partner. And along with Randy Levine, who went out and brought in just gobs and gobs of new revenue, off-field, on-field revenue, they were able to do this thing, which has never been done before. They built a team from scratch without ever tearing down the old one. So no tank job like the Chicago Cubs, no tank job like the Houston Astros, no tank job like the Boston Red Sox or the Cleveland Indians. This team was competitive every year. Paul, never won fewer than 84 games.
Paul Soltarev is our guest, co-author of Inside the Empire. You're listening to Inside the Game with Pat Williams. Back for more after this. You're listening to AM 660, The Answer in Orlando. Paul Soltarev is the co-author of a new book called Inside the Empire, The True Power Behind the New York Yankees. Paul, tell us about the relationship between the Yankee front office over the years and manager Joe Torre.
Well, before I answer that, let's go talk about the big news, at least in terms of melodrama in this book. And that is the relationship between the Yankees and their most iconic living player, Derek Jeter.
Okay.
So things fell apart between Cashman and Jeter in 2010, when they sat down at the bargaining table and Jeter demanded $150 million, or so we've been told, at the end of his career, when he was at best a replacement value shortstop. And Levine essentially laughed him out of the building. Not Levine, Cashman laughed him out of the building. And Jeter said to him, with his agent present, "Well, who would you rather have playing shortstop for the New York Yankees?" And Cashman listed off five shortstops before Jeter's agent, Casey Close, begged him to stop. So from that point forward, there was essentially no relationship between Jeter and his general manager. This becomes crucial when Jeter takes over the Florida Marlins and immediately alienates his best player, Giancarlo Stanton, essentially orders him to accept the trade to wherever the Marlins want to send him. And Stanton, who was the reigning MVP of the National League, told Jeter where to stuff it. And because he had a no-trade clause, he had all the leverage. So here's Jeter, neophyte owner, having squandered any leverage he has with his own best asset, forced to do a trade with his least favored trade partner, Brian Cashman, and in fact does a deal so awful, gets so little in return, that he has to attach a check of $30 million to Stanton's back in order to make the deal go through. So the Yankees get the reigning MVP. They pay nothing, and in fact, they get $30 million to offset salary. So that's just the first chapter. In the same chapter, we tell the story of how Cashman and Joe Torre had come to a pretty ugly pass. Cashman had saved Torre's job multiple times from George, who wanted to fire him after several seasons in which the Yankees came up short. And for his loyalty to Torre, he was repaid by Torre's backstabbing in a book called The Yankee Years in 2009. And Cashman was just gobsmacked by this. He had no idea that it was coming. And in fact, as we report, when he confronted Torre about the remarks in the book, before the book came out, Torre said, never said it. And then, of course, 2 days later, the book comes out and he said it. So we tell the story about Torre's final contract negotiation when he asked for the sun, moon, and stars. They said no, and he essentially storms out of there and winds up settling for about half of what the Yankees were offering with the Los Angeles Dodgers, where although he makes the playoffs, he never again goes to the World Series. So, you know, there's a lot in this book that is a huge surprise to people who know the game, know this team, or thought they did. This is a book about a team that everyone thought they had a fix on, but it turns out they are radically different than they have been portrayed.
Why was Joe Girardi fired as the manager, and why was Aaron Boone hired?
So we tell that story at great length. There was an interesting progression. The Yankees had three managers who could not have been much more different from one another. And Torre, who was originally this wonderful fatherly character, who was able to put his players at ease and to really kind of run a smooth clubhouse. He ran his course with them. He was replaced by his polar opposite, Jeff Girardi, who was essentially a New Jersey state trooper, wearing a Yankee warm-up jacket. And that was an effective approach for about 3 years. And then players began to really tire of, you know, his militaristic scheduling and temperament. And as the years went on, millennials began to come up through the chain, and they had no use at all for Girardi. Mm-hmm. And as we point out in the book, the job of a manager has changed entirely in the last 5 years. If you can't manage millennials now, you have no business being scared. If you can't relate to them, if you can't speak to them, in a way that recruits the best from them without hurting their tender feelings, you will not hold your job for very long.
Now, Aaron Boone comes along. What do we know about Aaron?
We know he's good at that. We know because he is so, he's so charming. He has what I call the connectivity gene. He can make anybody he talks to feel like they've known him forever and vice versa within 5 minutes. And he had this instinctive feel for not only how to talk to these kids, but how to command loyalty and respect from them. And, you know, in addition to extremely high brain processing speed, we tell the story of how the Yankees sat him down to do all these blind metric tests before they did the formal interview. During the formal interview, one of those tests was they handed him the really abstruse deep stats of 9 players on their roster and asked him to put together a batting order. And no names, no home run totals that would identify who was who. Really, you know, deep state stuff. And he put together a lineup that was exactly the one that he started opening day with. And so they knew they had their man. But again, a manager these days is much more of, you know, a kind of facilitator of culture than he is, you know, a game-by-game strategist. And how do you know that? Look at what they get paid. So Joe Torre was the highest paid manager in baseball when he exited the Yankees in 07. It was 07 when he was getting $7.5 million. And Joe Madden's getting $5 million now, and he's the highest paid manager in baseball all these years later. Aaron Boone makes about $2, maybe $2.5 million. So managers are no longer seen as these irreplaceable kind of centers of authority and strategy. Strategy is now all the quantitative analysis guys who are providing a running feed, not just game to game, but during game. So the most important part of a manager's job, as I say, is to keep the loyalty and the attention of his players throughout the season. And that he is good at. What we have yet to see is whether that capacity gets him through October. Good April through September, but we have a very small sample size. We'll need to see more from Aaron Boone in the postseason to make a judgment.
Paul, tell us about Hal and Hank Steinbrenner.
Well, not much to say about Hank because he has really marginalized himself. He was the presumptive heir. He looked like George, sounded like George, thought of the Yankees as essentially the same dinosaur that his father did. And that didn't work. Just didn't work. And for those and other more complicated personal reasons, he wound up being nudged aside in favor of Hal Steinbrenner. And Hal just could not be more gracious, more, as I say, praise deflecting, more of a consensus builder. He is the spitting image of the new corporate executive. So he's someone who delegates, but who is the final decider. And he's likable, he's good to his word, and he treats people beautifully. And the Yankees, as you may remember under George, couldn't hold on to anybody. couldn't keep a manager, couldn't keep a general manager, couldn't keep minor league personnel, key personnel, largely because of George.
My and guest now, has been Paul Solotaroff.
Yeah.
Paul, we've run out of time here on Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. This is AM 660, The Answer in Orlando. And we'll see you next week for more sports talk. Have a good week ahead.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.